This is Medical Spa MD.
Dr. LaPuma, why don't you tell me a little bit? You were an internal medicine physician, and now you're, of course, an author. You lecture, and you write books. How did that transition actually happen?
Oh, Jeff, it really wasn't a transition. The best advice I got about careers was to add them instead of change them. And I have tried to do that ever since I graduated from medical school and did my internal medicine residency. I have always written, I think. I did an ethics fellowship and general internal medicine fellowship, and there I wrote scientific papers, and after that, my first book on ethics consultation, but didn't write a book for the public until I met Mike Roizen of Real Age at the time at the University of Chicago, and then we wrote The Real Age Diet and Cooking the Real Age Way together, and more recently I've written ChefMD's Big Book of Culinary Medicine, and I'm fortunate that all of the books have done very well.
Is that kind of reminds me of two things. As you said, add careers as opposed to change them, which is something that I find very interesting. Does that mean that how do you avoid the master of jack of all trades, master of none? Then, if you're adding, in a sense, is an entirely different career. Am I wrong?
I think of the base for everything I do, Jeff, as medicine, and I still see patients and practice medicine specifically focusing on long-term weight loss and on accountability for that weight loss with lifestyle measures, and then secondarily with lifestyle measures to help people lower cholesterol and keep it off, avoiding or reducing dependence on statins especially, and thirdly on anti-aging strategies that are lifestyle strategies for people who simply want to try to function at an optimal level. I don't think of, and that work that is clinical, it really informs everything that I do. I really haven't thought about it as separate careers because it's all based in patient care and patient choice, medical ethics, and writing about strategies for people to make themselves better with what they eat and with lifestyle changes. And to some extent, my hobbies as well.
So the careers or the career paths that might be kind of either concurrent or parallel, have you chosen those or have they just kind of, have you taken an opportunity to kind of delve into those as they kind of came along? I mean, was that part of your plan, to kind of move into publication and then move into speaking and then potentially move into television, which you've done quite a bit of, or were those kinds of just happy coincidences?
I wouldn't call what I've done a plan, Jeff. I think that would be giving it too much credit. I have always been lucky in having really good teachers, and I was raised with a sense of intellectual curiosity. I was encouraged to pursue ideas and interests, even though they were not necessarily in the mainstream. So when I was in internal medicine residency, for example, in Los Angeles, the kinds of questions about patients that I was most interested in were who they were and where they were from and what their beliefs were and how they got to the hospital with liver failure instead of, what their prothrombin time was. I was quite interested, I needed to be in the prothrombin time, but I was more interested in what their family background was and where they were in life before they got to the hospital because I hoped and expected they would go home. So I followed that up with a fellowship in medical ethics because that was the place to learn about that kind of interest. And I did the same with cooking. I went to cooking school because I had patients who I didn't know what to tell except to go to a dietitian for their obesity and hyperlipidemia and stress levels. And I knew I needed to learn about that myself because I'd gained a lot of weight and was having trouble keeping it off and managing it despite the kind of high-profile part of my career at that point. So I went to cooking school to learn how to make a healthy diet taste good, and when I came back to practice, I found that that kind of knowledge was actually quite useful in patient care. And from that developed our real age interest and my very terrific partnership with Mike Roizen, who I admire a lot and is now the chief wellness officer at the Cleveland Clinic. And from there, it became clear that people were more and more interested in using food as medicine, especially, and that's how my work with ChefMD came up. It just seemed like the best way to communicate that interest and to talk to people about it was to try to make it a public forum. And television is great at that because it allows you to entertain and be kind of funny at the same time as teaching. And that's what I guess I like the most, the teaching part of it.
Which came first? Was it the notoriety or the higher profile that you had? Did that lead to the kind of media interest in what you were doing?
Well, I like to sort of skip the notoriety. I think that's probably not a desirable thing. The media interest in our work in ethics was, you know, from day one when I walked into the fellowship, and I began kind of a necessity talking with print and radio and occasionally television reporters about often about end-of-life issues. And so as part of my postgraduate training, I learned that talking to the media was just part of the work. And as I progressed through interests that I recognized or that kind of recognized me, I learned that it was really important to be able to translate what I was doing in the clinic and what my patient experiences and the patient experiences of my colleagues were to the general public because it's a fundamental curiosity about how the body works and how we can do more for ourselves. So I then did accept and seek really some additional training in media, and having been on Lifetime Television now for almost 5 years, once a week doing a 3.5-minute segment and co-hosting, I really am lucky in just being able to practice those skills. And media communication, and especially television, is a lot about being authentic. It's, even though it seems like it's acting, the camera is like another person. And if you can think about it as talking to another person and being authentic with them, trying to communicate directly and in ordinary language, you usually are able to connect with people in a way that very few others really can, except for doctors facing patients in a medical office or in a spa or any healthcare setting.
And so that kind of connection, or is that something that you actually learned? Were you, did that not come innately to you? Meaning, you know, when you're on camera or talking to the media or kind of putting your position across with authenticity, is that something that you already kind of had and you just had to change, or did you actually have to learn to a larger extent actually how to do that?
There's a producer joke that TV producers tell one another when they get someone who's really convincing in front of a camera. They say, eat a sincerity really well. And actors can, because they're trained in acting. But I'm not. I don't know that I could fake it. What I say on television, I actually really believe. And I guess, I don't know, I'm told that I connect well because of that. But I just think about it as talking with others in a way that's more entertaining than I get to do in the medical office, because, it, you know, that just wouldn't be appropriate.
Sure.
So it's probably a combination of both. I don't think about it as acting. I think about it as really helping people with food and stress and lifestyle.
Okay. And so you're also active not only, you know, on larger media, but you're active on social media. You have your own blog at ChefMD, and you've got drjohnlampuma.com. You've got Facebook, and I don't know if you're using, for example, Twitter, but, you know, it's certainly a possibility. How have you – did you know – were you an early adopter of kind of social media, and how has that affected other things that you have inside of your career? Mainly, well, not mainly, but also including your clinical practice. Has that been kind of a boon, or is that something that just kind of takes away from patient time?
I love social media. I think social media is critical for physicians. I think we will learn to use it in a therapeutic way. I do have several blogs and a Facebook and LinkedIn page, and your listeners who want to connect on LinkedIn, I'd love to meet you that way. I also have Twitter accounts for John LaPuma and ChefMD, and I think of it as other ways to make connections, things that are just modern ways to make connections. We used to do it more face to face over wine and cheese, but now it's done this way, and so when you get together with someone face to face over wine and cheese, it often has more depth, which I think is really interesting. I guess I do consider myself an early adopter, but I haven't been rabid about it. I haven't grown my Facebook following to 100,000 or more, which is kind of what you need to land a book contract, which is part of what I'm talking about in Las Vegas at the Medical Fusion Conference. And it has not really affected, as far as I can tell, my clinical practice, which is remains small and really special to me because I really like my patients. They're very wonderful people who tend to be highly interested and accomplished and find me because someone has heard about my work and their doctor refers them where they come directly. And so I just think about it as an integrated whole. I don't really separate it as marketing or advertising. I don't really think of it that way. I think about it as trying to connect with other people who have similar interests and find out about what they know.
Well, and do you find that that is, you might not be thinking of that as marketing or promotion, but in effect it is. I mean, the connection is part of that. Have you found that to be effective in building a relationship that actually helps the business aspects of what it is that you're doing?
I think I have not examined it in that way. I'm not on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter because I'm trying to, for example, recruit new patients or find a new speaking gig or get paid for doing more television or something like that. I do it because it's a way to, I'm active in those four because they're all ways I can express myself and connect with other people who care about the same things. I think if I was going to quantify it on an hour per dollar way, the hours would far outstrip the dollars. And yet there are people like Gary Vaynerchuk, for example, who have VaynerMedia.com, who insists that, in fact, and his own Wine Library TV is a good example of this, that if you do grow your business online and follow online, many other good things will follow. Seth Godin, of course, is the premier example in the book world, book publishing world. But I'd say that those kinds of followings are few and far between. And I think once in a while, I think mostly, Jeff, I can't really tell what will be a good connection and what not. It's kind of like medical school in a way. You were supposed to learn everything you could, and you couldn't imagine that any of it would be relevant because all you wanted to do was go out and see patients. At least that's how I felt. But it turns out that a lot of that stuff, at least for me, does come around again. It is relevant, and the details of a Krebs cycle, which are always cited as the most arcane possible chemical reaction, it turned out to be quite helpful in nutrition and metabolism, and that's a lot of what I do now. So I think that those connections are worth making because you don't quite know which relationships are going to be mutually beneficial, and because you, again, connect with people who have common interests. It's pretty easy to get distracted and waste time, and I think you have to learn not to do that if you have a tendency towards sitting in front of a PC or a Mac and have some modest degree of addiction, but with some skill, you can control it and I think create value, although the value is not the same as doing another operation or doing another procedure. It's more of a down-the-line return on investment. At least that's how I think of it.
I've always thought of it as a little bit kind of like compounding interest. It's something that you kind of, put a dollar a day away somewhere, but accumulates over time, because one of the things that is different when you are communicating on the web or you're making connections on the web or with technology is that they linger. If you're having a discussion, if we were having this discussion in your office, you and I would be privy to it and hopefully we'd derive some benefit, but nobody else would have access to that. It's kind of like the difference between sending somebody an email and posting that same content on your blog is that then there's an accrual of information and benefits to a larger group of people over time. And the other thing is that it's a little bit, when you were speaking, I was reminded of the reason that I would always go to medical conferences is that I never knew what I was actually going to find. It's one of those things that you go to a conference hoping that you're going to come across one or two things that are going to make the conference worthwhile. And to be honest, I have never found that not to be the case, where I've gone to a conference of any kind, really, and come away thinking, this was a complete waste of time, I shouldn't have come. I've always kind of come away saying, okay, this bit of information fits in this place and is really beneficial, especially if you might be talking about something that potentially changes your career, or you're saving money on a $100,000 piece of technology or something like that. So I've always kind of thought that it is a kind of worthwhile in the way that it leaves a little bit of, breadcrumbs that always kind of lead to you and develops relationships exactly the way that you're talking. So of the social media that you are employing or using, what do you like actually the best? I mean, do you spend most of your time on Facebook? Do you spend it on your own blog? Do you, Twitter to your existing patients?
I think what I like the best is writing on my own blog, because of what you've just mentioned. It's a good investment in a body of knowledge and a train of thought, and it allows me to keep up with people while telling them what I'm doing and what I'm thinking. It becomes an added piece of original content, which then can be reused in any number of other ways and posted on each of those social media sites in one form or another, and it is important, in my opinion, to post them in different forms for different social media sites. I find LinkedIn the best professional connection place. My Facebook profile is actually for my actual friends, not my Facebook friends. My Facebook friends wind up on my Facebook fan page or my ChefMD fan page, and there are a couple thousand people on the ChefMD fan page and a few and less on my own page. And then Twitter, I guess I think of kind of as your online chit-chat / personality. And it has a wrap, I think, of people who are used to doing business face-to-face as being something that you talk about what you have for breakfast with. But instead, it, I think, is probably best used for communicating information right away. The rally to restore insanity, to restore sanity, excuse me, / fear that occurred with Jon Stewart and Steve Colbert this past weekend was really only publicized on Comedy Central, Facebook, and Twitter. Not one piece of direct mail, and they got over 300,000 people in Washington, D.C. That's pretty powerful, way more powerful than any other political rally just a few days before the election. And it shows, I think, how people who are engaged in social media, like clinicians who are interested in this work and savvy about it, can communicate and reach others who have similar interests. And I think, of course, this isn't true simply for politics or media or entertainment, although that's how it's primarily used now. But I can see a powerful role for this in public health, in lifestyle change, and in lifestyle change maintenance, and in wellness more broadly.
And so during your time in social media, are there any things that you have done that you would categorize as a mistake or that you wish that you hadn't done, either because it was wasted time or some other event kind of triggered that?
Oh, yes. I had a blog as early as 2002, I think. And I just didn't keep it up. I didn't understand how to use it or why. And I enrolled people in as members in the website. And when I changed websites and redid it, all that information was lost. And I didn't think that it mattered very much, but I was certainly wrong. And as a consequence, I had to rebuild it so that my own member newsletter list is probably 10% of what it could be. But that's okay. You know, you live and learn, and I think now is a great time to invest in social media for clinicians, especially, who are, of course, a little leery about putting their toe in the water because we're generally a conservative lot, but also because we don't want to violate HIPAA or other rules that govern clinical work. And I think it's worth looking at that carefully with some with legal advice. But I also think that sensible people will keep an eye in mind the principles of medical ethics, especially confidentiality, and use Facebook pages, especially and LinkedIn certainly, in ways that can actually improve employee wellness, diminish stress among followers and among people who are really interested in your personality, and do so in a way that, in many ways, I think may shape the future, not just anticipate it.
Do you think that physicians in the future will be known more as individuals as opposed to, you know, somebody who walks through the door and talks to you for 7 minutes and in a general family practice or internal medicine an outpatient clinic? Do you think that social media kind of extends the reach outside of the small amount of time that you're actually interacting with a patient, and that that is a benefit to physicians, or is that something that, you know, kind of counterbalances the weight of the advice that the physician gives inside of the consultation room? I don't know if I'm making myself very clear there, but what I'm wondering is, do you think that social media elevates or, you know, makes a friend of the physician, or, and is that a good thing for patients to have access to?
You know, I still think that the doctor-patient relationship is the most powerful tool that doctors have. And to the extent that social media encourages, tightens, improves on, and makes accessible that relationship, especially to people who want to know more about their doctor, it can only improve patient care. Now, there have already been anecdotal reports of social media diagnoses of CVAs and heart attacks, proposed treatment for emergency bites and trauma, but I'm confident that a more systematic clinical approach to social media will actually emerge so that patients will be able to follow their own physician, and the physician will be able to dispense advice that may be generally useful as well as specifically useful without it actually being medical practice that is open for liability or probably for reimbursement. Now, both of those things might occur. There might be instances where a physician will be liable for giving bad advice over Twitter, which, of course, makes you pause even to put that in a sentence. And it might be that enterprising clinicians will try to get paid for text messages to patients for specific prescription adjustment, for example. And there might be instances in which those will actually be good outcomes, that is, being in touch with patients and delivering clinical care in over social networking. But I think that for the future, I would say 5 to 7 years out. For now, I think what is available and what will help both clinicians and patients is to be a good steward of both the relationship and medical resources by providing more information than you can in a 7-minute visit on Facebook, through other social media, and through public fora that, as you alluded to earlier, can be reproduced in any number of other fora. And we haven't really mentioned YouTube, but I have 120 videos on YouTube from my ChefMD work and 25 or so on my own John LaPuma work. And those are videos that get comments all the time. And YouTube is the third most searched site after Google and Yahoo. And it's certainly the video site that drives the most traffic. There was a recent study of web traffic referred from video and multimedia sites, and YouTube, was 9-to-1 over the next competitor, which was Flickr, which, as you know, is a photo site. So I think that we're at the very infancy of this work, and that it has enormous potential to do good within corporations, with employees, and with the public at large. And the secret really will be a faithful connection, people who are able to keep in touch regularly, not as I did kind of once in a while, but at least once a week.
Okay. Now, you're going to be speaking at the Medical Fusion Conference, which is this coming weekend in Las Vegas. What are you going to be speaking about?
I'm going to be speaking about how to write a New York Times bestseller, which I've been privileged to do twice.
And can you give us a couple tips? Can you give us just a couple tips that you're going to, from what you're going to be saying?
The most important thing is to know Oprah. If you know Oprah and you send her your book and she likes it, then I think it's very good. And then the second most important thing is to know Gail King or Stedman, and hope one or both of them tell Oprah about the book and that she likes it. Short of that, or having your book made into a widely released and popular film, there are actually ways to learn about the New York Times list and to I think achieve it. I've been fortunate, as I mentioned, to do it twice. And this last time for ChefMD, nobody thought I could because they thought the book was too dense and not enough, not popularly written enough, not light enough. And of course, it tried to carve out a whole new field, the idea that culinary medicine could be the art of cooking blended with the science of medicine, which by itself sounds like it could be intriguing, but if you give people the nitty-gritty science of it, it's very easy to turn them off. But in fact, I was able to do it, and I had a lot of help, and what I'll be talking about is exactly what that help looks like and how the list evolved and why it's still important and why, although publishing is kind of broken as an industry and many publishers are going out of business, it's still, for most people who want to break in, especially with a first book, it's actually, I think, still quite important to at least evaluate what your goals are, whether you really want to spread the ideas, or if you want to become famous, or you want to make a lot of money, or you want to find other people who believe the same thing. And this, writing a New York Times bestseller presumes that you, or aiming to write one, presumes that you know what your goals are. And if your goals are to hit the list, then there's a whole bunch of other suppositions behind that, that you're really interested in the big time. And so I'll be describing what that big time is and how I got there and how I think others can get there. And I'll also be providing resources for those who want to find an agent and want to know how to market a book and how to self-publish as well.
And just to, by way of note, you do not know Oprah. Is that right?
No, I don't. Although I admire Miss Winfrey tremendously, and I have been in the audience in her show, but I've never been on her show.
Okay. So, well, Dr. LaPuma, let me thank you very much. We've gone at exactly 33 minutes, which, you know, fits our allotted time. I'm going to we'll probably end the show with my kind of thank you, and I want to give you my personal thank you, and I look forward to meeting you next week down in Las Vegas.
Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time to do this.
And let me just say again, thank you for taking your time again to do.
Thank you very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Would love to hear from you. So if you've got any questions or comments, send them along to the email address at podcast@medicalsparmd.com or leave a comment on the physicians forum on the medicalsparmd.com website. If you're a subscriber, that's great. If you haven't subscribed yet and you'd like this show to be downloaded automatically when a new episode comes along, then search for Medical Spa MD in iTunes, or visit the medicalsparmd.com website and click on podcast. Also, search for medicalsparmd on Twitter, on Facebook, and in LinkedIn, because you'll find us there as well. As always, please consider everything we say to be complete conjecture and random speculation, not medical or legal advice. Laws and regulations vary everywhere, so consult a medical or legal professional in your country before taking any action. So that's it. So it's goodbye from Andy White.
And goodbye from Jeff Barson.
Wishing you all the best, and we'll see you next time on Medical Spa MD.